This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Time to meet the needs of the outcast liberal progressives in Portland. 15 hours out of the 168 hours, KBOO is on the air each week. Please go to kboo.fm and look for Tom Hartman on KBOO, then take this two-question survey. If you are not currently a member, please join us today. Pass the link along to others. We need to hear from the entire community if we are to make informed decisions. Please understand that this is only an informational gathering survey to guide possible future programming changes. Please contact me if you have questions or concern. My door is always open. This has been KBOO Station Manager, Development Director, Executive Director, and Ever Watchful Navigator, Lynn Fitch. Thanks.
Do you have talents in fundraising, development, or new media? Are you an active KBOO member? Then here's your chance to bring your know-how to the KBOO Foundation Board of Directors. Applications are now being accepted for the 2013 election until midnight, June 28th. To apply, go to the kboo.fm homepage and click on KBOO Board of Directors Application.
You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time is approximately 11:01 a.m. Coming up on the Incomparable Radio Zine, the guest is journalist and science writer Sandy Doughton discussing her new book, Full Rip 9.0, The Next Big Earthquake in the Pacific Northwest. At 11:30, we hear KBOO's annual broadcast of the classic documentary Remembering Stonewall, produced by David Isay in 1989, on the 20th anniversary of the event that is often seen as the birth of the queer liberation movement. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support for community radio. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
And good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine. 9.0 is a figure that can strike fear in the hearts of many residents of Cascadia. Full Rip 9.0, The Next Big Earthquake in the Pacific Northwest, is the title of a new book by journalist Sandy Doughton, who is with us today on the Radio Zine. Scientists have identified Seattle, Portland, and Vancouver as the urban centers of what will be the biggest earthquake in the continental United States. Sandy reports on the scientists who are trying to understand when, where, and just how big the big one will be. Sandy Doughton writes about science for the Seattle Times, and she is speaking about Full Rip 9.0 tonight at 7:30 at Powell City of Books. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Now, how did you come to write about this megaquake opportunity in the area and about the scientists working on this?
Well, I have been covering earthquake science and earthquake threats in the Pacific Northwest for about 20 years now. And I could see that the science has changed radically and our understanding of the risk has changed radically. And people are just kind of starting to wrap their heads around it here in the Pacific Northwest, because it's a big change from what we thought the situation was before. So it seemed like a good time to kind of pull together all the stories of these remarkable scientists who have, you know, whose work has really provided us with the gift of foresight, knowing what's going to happen, and also talking about some of the implications of a big quake like that and what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. And you begin the book with sort of a recreation of what it was like in this area in 1700 when a 9.0 earthquake lashed the Pacific Northwest coast. Can you talk about the scene you created and contrast it with what the scene might look like in the same area today?
It was interesting because that quake did occur in 1700. That was more than 300 years ago. But there were a lot of people here. There were a lot of Native Americans and First Nations people were living here. And the quake occurred in January. So they would have been gathered down by the coast, along river mouths, in very, very vulnerable places. So I just tried to imagine what it would have been like for them, not even knowing what we know now about the science of the fault, just to have in the middle of a cold January night, the ground start shaking so hard that people would just be thrown into the air. And then, you know, the shaking just going on for minutes and minutes and minutes, which is really kind of hard to comprehend. And one analogy that I came up with is that if you go to a baseball game and you listen to him sing the national anthem, that takes about 2 minutes. And that seems interminable. So imagine standing up for, you know, two versions of the national anthem. That's 4 minutes. And that's how long the ground is going to shake during one of these quakes, maybe more. So I just, you know, I just tried to imagine what that would have been like. And then when the shaking stopped and people would have thought, you know, thank God it's over, then the tsunami comes in. So, you know, and of course there were no cities. There was not development in the way we think of it now. And now those same areas are covered with roads and bridges and waterfront homes and our cities and our ports. And, you know, all of those are extremely vulnerable.
Now, maybe give us a basic, at the very beginning of your book is basically about the rediscovery of this 1700 earthquake and how it came to light. And it's quite interesting with how scientists got certain kinds of knowledge through different kinds of research and put this all together. But give us a basic outline of how that happened.
Well, as you said, it is a fascinating story. I mean, I consider it to be one of the greatest geologic detective stories ever, because you know what the scientists did was basically uncover these clues that were not at all obvious, and interpret them to understand what they meant. And it started with a scientist for the USGS named Brian Atwater, who was poking around out on the Washington coast. Because at the time, people knew that this big fault existed off the coast, but there was a lot of disagreement over whether it could generate big earthquakes or whether it had generated big earthquakes in the past. And so Brian was out there to see if he could find some of these clues to this fault's behavior. This was in the early 1980s. And he thought he might see signs that the coast was rising, because that's what you would expect if this fault was harmless and these tectonic plates were just slipping past each other. But what he found was a big surprise, because he found that in places the ground had dropped abruptly in the past by, you know, a not insignificant amount, 3 to 6 feet, something like that. And he found, you know, digging underground, he found these layers of old soil that had dropped down. And eventually he expanded that search all up and down the coast and found, you know, in some places 9 of these layers, indicating 9 past earthquakes, and also layers of sand that were washed so far inland that he realized the only way they could have gotten there is if there was a massive tsunami.
And is that sort of the science of mud? Is that...
It is. Yeah, Brian is a specialist in mud, and when he... when he started thinking about earthquakes, you know, he was quite the outsider in the earthquake community, because he had never worked on earthquakes before. And they had a big meeting in Seattle to discuss this fault and whether it posed a threat. And Brian wanted to come, and they said, well, no, you can't come because you're a mud guy. And yet the mud is where the answer was found.
Uh-huh. And how exactly do they do that in exploring the mud? They have some kind of equipment that... reaches down and gets these layers of mud? How does that work?
Well, he does it in two ways. He has these just kind of cylinders, metal cylinders. They're called core barrels. And you just kind of plunge that into the ground, crank it around, and pull it out. And you come out with a small cylinder of mud. And you can see some of the layers there. But probably the most effective technique they use is to just go along stream banks, because the streams have already eroded down through the mud, and it just provides kind of a window right there for you. So he would canoe up and down these streams, scrape the banks, look at the layers, you know, measure them, examine what was in them, try to radiocarbon date the material in them to establish when previous quakes occurred.
And there were also scientists working with vegetation, with trees and other forms of vegetation. How did that relate to finding out about the mega quake of 1700?
Well, when the quake occurred, the ground dropped, and so in a lot of places, in several places, there were forests growing near the coast or by these coastal streams. And when the ground dropped abruptly, those trees were killed because salt water washed in over their roots. And so the scientists were able to, you know, in some cases, extract tree rings, you know, count the tree rings, and also extract samples for carbon dating from those trees as well, to get a good idea of when they were killed.
Yeah, you have a story of some scientists who found out that some trees, some very old ancient trees, were being cut on an island, and they scoped out that they could sneak onto the island after those trees were mm-hmm. cut and look at the stumps.
Yeah, that's correct. It, you know, tree ring dating is not as simple as it seems, and these researchers had found a very good, what they called, ghost forest out on the Washington coast. And this was a stand of old cedars that had been killed in the last earthquake. But the outer rings were all gone, because these trees had been standing for three centuries. So they were able to get kind of a rough estimate of their ages, but quite rough. And in order to pin it down more precisely, they needed reference trees. And so these are trees of about the same age, the same type, where you know the year that they died. And they just happened to stumble across this big logging operation where Weyerhaeuser was cutting down some enormous old growth cedars out on this island, which was kind of unusual at the time, because almost all of the old trees had already been cut. And so what they would do is paddle over in a canoe after the loggers went home and cut out samples from the stumps. And then that gave them a reference sequence to which they could compare the sequences from the ghost forest. And that helped pin it down more precisely in time.
And so how did the date and size of this big mega quake, how did that finally get nailed down?
Yeah, that's just an amazing story. The people started thinking, you know, that when this quake occurred, that, you know, there were people here in the Northwest, but they didn't have any written language. The Native Americans didn't have written language. But on the other side of the ocean is Japan, and people in Japan have been studying quakes for more than 1,000 years. And so if there was a big earthquake and tsunami here in the Northwest, there's a good chance that wave would have crossed the Pacific and hit Japan. And the same thing happened here 2 years ago when Japan had its big megaquake and tsunami, because the tsunami came across the ocean. It didn't do much damage in Oregon or Washington, but it hit some places in California really hard and actually killed a person. So so why wouldn't it have gone in the opposite direction? And a Japanese tsunami researcher started poking around in the old records, and Japan just has these amazing compilations of historic observations and, you know, things people wrote down about quakes and tsunamis. And, you know, searching through these records, he found several reports from the coast of Japan where several villages were flooded mysteriously because people thought, well, it seems like a tsunami, but they hadn't felt the earthquake because the earthquake, of course, was on the other side of the ocean. And using those observations from Japan and then building a computer model that, let him figure out how long it would have taken the wave to cross the ocean from the northwest and hit Japan, this researcher, Kenji Satake, was able to put a precise date and time on the last quake, January 26th, 1700 at 9 p.m.
I'm speaking with Sandy Dalton. She is a journalist and science writer, and she's author of the new book, Full Rip 9.0. She's speaking at Powell City of Books downtown tonight at 7:30. So the whole issue of the intervals is also very important in what we're talking about, the intervals between quakes and megaquakes particularly. Talk about that, what the knowledge of that has been, how that has maybe changed as this kind of research has come to light, and what is current now in the feelings or thoughts and learning about this.
Well, everybody always wants to know, are we overdue for the big one? And it's a really hard question to answer, and in a way it's really impossible because it's not like these earthquakes occur on a regular schedule. The intervals between them can vary all over the place, and looking back at the record that we have now, these really big quakes, the Full Rip 9 quakes, have been separated by as little as 200 years or less and as much as 900 years. So you can calculate an average from that, and that's what people use when they talk about being overdue. But how meaningful is that average? The Earth doesn't pay attention, to our calculations. The latest science suggests that that there has been one of these really, really big quakes about every 500 years on average. But some even newer research, primarily from off the Oregon and California coast, suggests that there might be partial rip earthquakes that just rip the southern half of this big fault off the coast and generate earthquakes of magnitude 8 or so, that those things might occur, every 500 years or so. And then when you put those all together, what you come up with is that the Northwest has been hit by a big earthquake, and that's either like an 8 or a 9 or even bigger every 250 years on average. Now, there's still some disagreement among scientists about the evidence for those quakes exclusively off Oregon and Northern California, but I think there's no doubt that some of them did occur.
Mm-hmm. And we know this. We know the expected interval based on similar kinds of research. What is the research going on that brought to light what you just talked about?
The earthquakes off the Oregon coast, yeah. Well, there are sort of two main lines of evidence that give us insight into how frequently these quakes have struck in the past. There's the work that's done on land that I talked about earlier, digging around in these marshes and looking for buried soil layers. And then there's another very fascinating line of research pioneered by Chris Goldfinger at Oregon State University that involves extracting sediment cores from the seafloor off the coast. Because what happens in these big quakes is that between quakes, you have huge amounts of sediment washing out onto the continental shelf, mainly from the Columbia River and other rivers. And it builds up. But when you get a big quake, that shakes it loose. And what happens are these just incredibly enormous landslides called turbidites just come roaring down off the continental shelf and travel miles and miles out onto the seafloor. And what Chris and his colleagues have been able to do with their cores is to see the layers left by these landslides and count them. And so for the big quakes, he sees big, thick layers on the seafloor. Mm-hmm. And for the quakes, the smaller quakes off the Oregon coast and in the Northern California coast, he sees thinner layers. And so that's where the disagreement comes in, because some people say, well, there could be other things that cause smaller landslides and thinner layers than earthquakes. But Chris is also finding evidence from the shore, looking in lakes and seeing these layers of sand that were washed in by tsunamis, and coordinating those with the landslides that he sees offshore. So many of those have been validated that way.
Mm-hmm. And it brings us to Oregon. You live in Seattle, and you write a lot about the fault in Seattle. And there's some interesting references in your book to Oregon and Portland. For instance, there's a quote by one person who says, "Washington is the bumper and Oregon the back seat of the car that's going along for the ride as far as megaquakes." Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, Oregon is equally vulnerable to these coastal megaquakes as Washington. What that quote was referring to are other types of quakes that we get in the Northwest that seem to occur more frequently further north up in Washington. And these are deep quakes like the one we had in 2001, the Nisqually quake. And I know you felt that down here too. And then there are also,
I think, in this room. I remember being in this room actually.
Yeah. And then there are also California style quakes that occur on shallow faults. And all of these quakes have a common source, and that is the collision and movement of these tectonic plates. But the way the continent is structured, what happens is that Oregon kind of rotates under this pressure, whereas Washington, which is pinned up against British Columbia, which is some really hard bedrock, Washington is getting crumpled more than Oregon is. And that crumpling of Washington accounts for the fact that we have quakes more frequently than Oregon does. But it doesn't mean that Oregon can't get them. You definitely can, and you have gotten them in the past. But the state as a whole, these big geologic blocks that make up the state of Oregon, aren't being squeezed as hard by these forces.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, mm-hmm. it's interesting to try to picture that and mm-hmm. think about what that might mean. So I guess when we talk about Oregon and southern Washington, we would all want to know about Hanford and how Hanford fits into the current picture as far as mm-hmm. earthquakes and their possibility.
Well, this is very interesting because, you know, there's been this progression of understanding around the Northwest, and we sort of started off thinking that the whole region was not very earthquake prone. And then people realized, oh, yeah, you know, the west side is pretty earthquake prone. And just now, recently, scientists are starting to do a lot more work on central and eastern Washington and Oregon, and discovering that those same forces that are squeezing and squishing and crumpling the state are manifest over there as well in a series of faults that run, some of them very close to the Hanford nuclear reservation. And these are things that people didn't quite understand when those facilities were built. So I think there is kind of a general consensus now that the earthquake risk over there is higher than people realized. And there was a very fascinating earthquake that occurred in 1872 that was one of the biggest ever in the Northwest. And because it happened before seismometers or anything, there was a big debate over where that quake was located. And it became kind of a tug of war between utilities that wanted to build nuclear plants around the state.
Right.
And nobody wanted that quake in their backyard. So you had these kind of dueling consultant reports saying it was here, it was there. But that quake was over on the east side of Washington. So that's an example of the type of quake that can occur over there.
And what's your opinion about the state of research about that particular area and how it might be affected by earthquakes? Is there a lot of it going on, or is it less?
I think that's that kind of the focus is sort of shifting over there now because a lot of work has been done characterizing, you know, particularly Western Washington and Western Oregon, and you know, and it just seems like that the thread leads east now, and that's where people are doing a lot of research. And I know that the Department of Energy, which is in charge of the, you know, the waste, the nuclear waste stored at Hanford, is, you know, has been looking into this, taking another look at what the potential earthquake threats might be over there.
And it's interesting that a lot of the information that has come out about a lot of the research that was done about the 1700 quake came about because of plans to build a mm-hmm. nuclear reactor mm-hmm. in Washington State that was then never built by WPS.
Right, exactly. That was WPS was going to build. WPS was the Washington Public Power Supply System, which was a utility consortium that, starting in the 1970s, wanted to build 5 nuclear power plants around the region. And they weren't the only one. You know, utilities in Oregon were looking into this, and other utilities in Washington. And so, at that time, there were probably about a dozen nuclear power plants on the drawing board. And this particular set of reactors by the Washington coast near the town of Satsop was kind of what kicked off this reevaluation of the seismic risk around here, because people had known that this fault existed off the coast. A lot of people assumed that it wasn't dangerous, that it couldn't generate quakes. And so the Nuclear Regulatory Commission brought in the USGS to take a look at that and reevaluate it. And when they looked at all the evidence, they said, you know, hey, we don't see any reason that this fault could not generate a big quake. This is something we need to start thinking about.
And where is the future of science on megaquakes in the Pacific Northwest going?
It's a lot of the research is shifting off sure, because that's where these tectonic plates meet. There's a big seam off the seafloor, which is it's kind of the leading edge of the fault. And the closer you can get to the fault, the more accurate your measurements are going to be, the better you will be able to measure small quakes that might be occurring off there that aren't picked up well on land by land-based seismometers. So Canada and the United States have both already started installing these underwater observatories. And just at the end of this month, scientists from the University of Washington and Oregon State and other institutions are going to be going off the coast of Oregon and adding some instruments to those underwater observatories there. And what those will include will be seismometers. So they'll be able to pick up these quakes, get a better idea of how seismically active things are off there. Instruments that can measure if a tsunami is coming will be able to give you a better idea of how big it is, and you know, help with tsunami warnings. And eventually, they hope to put in what are called tilt meters that would be able to pick up, you know, any kind of creeping motion on that fault. I mean, there's never been any proven way to say that a fault is getting ready to go. But people are continuing to look at it, and there were some interesting things that happened off Japan where that fault did creep a little bit before it ripped a couple of years ago. Now, whether that would ever be useful as a predictor remains to be seen, but we won't know if we don't go out there and measure it.
Sandy, we just have maybe a minute left. How, after doing all this research for these many years in this area, in this journalism, how safe do you feel here in the Pacific Northwest?
You know, that's a tough question. I mean, you know, you can feel unsafe anywhere. I do feel that here in the Pacific Northwest, people are starting to appreciate this, and I really think, you know, Oregon is probably leading that effort to some extent. And I feel like I can personally take measures, you know, for my own safety and preparedness. But I think as a society, we need to look at these bigger issues, our buildings, our infrastructure, our roads. And if we as a society don't deal with that, then the aftermath of this quake will be much worse than it needs to be.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for coming in and talking about this and remind people again. I've been speaking with Sandy Doughton. Her book is Full Rip 9.0. She will be talking about it tonight at 7:30 at Powell City of Books. And she also writes for the Seattle, she writes in Seattle and for which?
The Seattle Times.
The Seattle Times. And I thank you again for coming in to KABU, Sandy.
Thank you so much.
And stay tuned. Coming up is our annual rebroadcast of Stonewall Remembered, a documentary done in 1989. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KABU.
Today, this white two-story building across from Sheridan Square in Greenwich Village is a clothing store and a closed Chinese restaurant. 20 years ago, this was the Stonewall Inn. I'm Michael Shirker, and I'm working on the first comprehensive history of the Stonewall riots. In 1969, the Stonewall was one of the most popular gay bars in New York City, and, like all other gay bars, was routinely raided by the Vice Squad. The patrons of these bars, many of whom were frightened at having their identities revealed, would quietly submit to any orders coming from the police. Yet, on June 27th, 1969, that all changed. The patrons of this bar, with the drag queens at the forefront, decided to fight back against the police. What happened here on that night would spark a revolution.
I am Gene Harwood, and my age is 80.
I'm Bruce Merrill.
He also would like to know what your age is. So you
my
tell
age,
him your age.
78. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't know if it's really true, but now people do refer to us as the two oldest gay men in America. We do, have maybe a record relationship of almost 60 years together.